Women Making Moves, where we celebrate the moves that women are making. My name is Amy Ponce. I'm founder of Unlock the Magic Coaching, Marketing, and Energy Healing. I'm joined today with Rachel Dumas. Rachel is a registered nurse, maternal health advocate, and founder of A Light After Nine, a nonprofit that supports families dealing with pregnancy loss, infertility, and maternal health disparities. As a woman making bold moves in the maternal health space, Rachel draws on her personal journey, enduring 9 miscarriages and eventually delivering her miracle baby who spent time in the NICU. These experiences inspire her to provide emotional, financial, and mental health support to families while fiercely advocating for equitable maternal care, especially for women of color. Rachel doesn't shy away from the uncomfortable but necessary conversations in maternal health. She speaks openly about the challenges women face, including pregnancy loss, medical gaslighting, and the disparities in care for women of color. Through her nonprofit, keynote speaking, and advocacy, Rachel empowers others to confront these tough issues head on, creating impactful change in the maternal healthcare system. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Reading that, it's hard for me not to draw in any energy of the game-changing decisions that are happening, especially for women's autonomy and bodies.
Yes.
How are you feeling amidst all this?
It's a scary feeling, honestly, and I'm just praying for the best at this point.
I feel like so many people are maybe not aware, haven't experienced, although I have to tell you, Rachel, almost every woman I talk to, there has been some sort of an inequity or an imbalance in a healthcare matter that they have, whether it be, like you said, gaslighting, or when I was in the hospital, a male doctor put a 4-inch needle on the top of my vulva without my consent or knowing, just did it.
Wow.
Ooh, it seems like every woman has a trauma.
Yes.
As it relates to medical care.
Yes.
Yikes.
Yes. It's crazy to think that the people who are responsible for the trauma have normalized it in their minds. He probably didn't even think anything of putting a needle on top of you when he did it. And it's so common now. Thankfully, it's become a hot topic. Hopefully that it's not just a short period of talking about these things, because we need a major change in healthcare setting in general, not just in maternal care, where we feel safe and can trust our providers.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Do you think it's because we've gotten to this place where we've kind of associated corporate America to the healthcare system, meaning churn, more patients, faster? Yeah, is it that?
I think it's a combination of things. I do believe that that has a lot to do with it. I would love to think that hospitals are delivering patient focused, patient priority, patient oriented care. But that's not always the case. The clinicians, while they're not executives or even paying attention to the income, they are feeling that pressure because it trickles down to them to hurry up and turn that bed over, hurry up and see that patient. You have other governing bodies just placing limitations on them and the amount of time they can see patients. So they're rushing and they really can't do much about it unless we make these changes in the polls.
Right. And a lot of times what you and I just did is we provided how we got here. And some people will hear that as, oh, they're justifying. No, we are not. We are giving, for me, advocating for change on any front includes the understanding of the origin point.
Right.
And so that you can start to dismantle it. And I feel that way about any industry, any workplace, society right now that is still rooted in white supremacy, patriarchy, colonialism, capitalism. And so
absolutely
deeper is the systems. And there is no easy direct answer as to which or how or what or where.
Right.
It's simply having this awareness and conversation. So I appreciate you coming today to talk about the healthcare, maternal care, especially. So Rachel, you're speaking on beyond, and I'm so sorry for the loss of your 9 babies.
Thank you so much for that.
And love to hear more about your miracle baby. What I feel I understand from you is that we're talking more about more than just the prenatal care. We're obviously talking day of getting into the hospital, water broke, or you started your labor process. I've talked to women in the past on the show about how important the sheer energy, the energy that everyone's bringing into that room that day.
Yes. And
so when you talk about maternal health, can you give us an end-to-end, what you're talking about? Because it's more inclusive than pre, post, during, and even after. It's all of it, right?
Right. So when we talk about maternal health care, we're talking about before the pregnancy process, like you're preparing to go along that pregnancy journey. Once that journey begins and you get a positive pregnancy test, the labor and delivery process and the postpartum process, all of that is the maternity journey. And that's all that I'm addressing today and in the future. So like you said, it starts with listening to mom way before we get into the labor and delivery room, because those times matter. I didn't get into the labor and delivery room until 2022. My pregnancy journey started in 2018. You know, all of that time matters, and I'll be remiss to say that it doesn't. We have to start listening to moms. Our maternal death rate is so high, especially in the South. I'm in Georgia. For Black women, at one point, it was number two. It's awful. I went to that labor and delivery room more afraid for my life than I was during my pregnancy journey, which was traumatic. So the whole experience was traumatic. And to say that, knowing that we are responsible for repopulating the earth and bringing life into this world, and to label that experience as traumatic, is so sad. It's so sad.
Well, because especially the moment something turns emergent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to simplify, there are lives at stake, absolutely. And even in an emergency, it's like, okay, something isn't as expected. So let's talk through the options. And I don't know if you have that much time to do it like that, but I like how you're saying it's all encompassing. What do you think about even before conception to a person who wants to get pregnant? What do you want to feel when you get pregnant? Do you know what I'm saying? Going even back a step further. And the reason, Rachel, I bring that up is because for those who identify as women, we can easily get associated to procreation being our value. And so I wanted to see what you thought on level setting within the womb space to begin with.
Right. Because I do feel like we have that pressure to procreate. Right. And then it's like taboo to say I have fertility issues. I feel like it's more talked about now than ever. I feel like it's been an issue, but it's more talked about now. It's becoming a little less taboo, but still taboo nonetheless. And society has created this culture of women are supposed to give birth, women are supposed to have a child by this age. Oh my gosh, she had a miscarriage. What's wrong with her? You know, it's so scary to think that my value is defined by whether I had a child or not. You know, and we feel that pressure and we feel that guilt if we can't have a child or if we choose to not have a child. I don't know which guilt is worse, to be honest, but the fact that it's there is insane.
So I'm a woman who chooses not to have a child. And I will say that I don't feel any type of way about it. Other people do. And I'll get comments. And depending on where I'm at that day, personally, it depends on how I'll respond. So for me personally, I don't feel guilt toward it, but I do not enjoy comments being made about it.
Right.
But also, I'm a larger woman. So every time I'm out and about once a month or so, it used to happen more often, I'll be asked what I'm due.
Wow.
I started responding with, oh, I'm not pregnant, I'm just fat. And the person's face, you're like, you do not say that. I absolutely say that. If you're going to come at me with something like that, come on. So that's how I handle it.
Now we're both uncomfortable.
Exactly. I'm like, you're going to make me uncomfortable. I'm going to make you uncomfortable.
I have a similar post about other questions I'm asking, but I want this posed on this podcast.
Wait, what'd you say?
I say I have similar responses to other intrusive questions that I've been asked, but I won't disclose what the response is on the podcast.
You're going to have to tell me offline. So in Georgia, and especially through your journey, why, in your experience, expertise, is the reality of the entire U.S., which is supposed to be so far advanced, the mortality rate for pregnant women of color is the highest? And to your point number two, in Georgia, why?
Yeah, so there are combinations of reasons. Again, one of the biggest reasons is a lack of access. So we have what's called access deserts, where women who need prenatal care, and God forbid you have a high risk pregnancy, but you don't have high risk specialists in your area, and you're traveling an hour or two away. You can't wait an hour or two for emergency. So that's a big issue. The other issue, which I believe why the maternal death rate is so high, is that we're not getting listened to. We're saying this complaint, we're saying that complaint. No, I'm bleeding. The bleeding is normal. Oh, I'm having pain. Pain is normal during pregnancy. Oh, you know, I'm feeling this symptom, I'm feeling that symptom, but we're getting gaslighted saying, oh, it's normal, or you'll be all right, you know, not doing any further investigation. So we need that advocacy, whether we're doing it ourselves and we don't know when or if to speak up or have the confidence to speak up. And then we need our providers to listen to us and do that further evaluation on us and solve those issues as soon as possible. So I really think listening, advocacy, and having access to healthcare are the big reasons why we're dying during our pregnancy journey, literally dying to have a baby.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, on a much smaller scale, I know what I've experienced as a white woman in my medical journey of just being told it is what it is, or like, oh, it's just hormones or all this bullshit that all women experience, and women of color or any woman non-white experiences that additional multi-layer of racism or of discrimination.
And then there are still doctors out there, and this is based on recent research, that believe Black women don't feel pain.
What? What?
Yes.
Why would that even be a thing? How
I
did that?
don't know why
What?
that's a thing. I don't
What?
know why that's a thing. So when we complain about it, we're definitely just cast to the side and it's not addressed.
Like, okay. How was that research even done, and who'd they ask?
I recently, like a couple of weeks ago, I'm also finishing my master's degree. I was writing a paper and I came across this research where they talked to various doctors and various Black women who are treated for different, very painful issues. I forgot the different type of issues. I know sickle cell was amongst one of them, and it was noted that the doctors didn't believe the pain level that the patient was reporting was as high as they said it was. So they didn't treat it like it was that high. But it's insane that we can go to the doctor with the same issues, the same pain, 10 out of 10 pain, 9 out of 10 pain as our white counterparts. And I'll receive Tylenol and be sent home, but my counterpart will receive morphine.
Yeah.
We both deserve morphine. We both deserve Dilaudid. You know, we both deserve to be comfortable and have a better quality of life. So it's another thing that, you know, we have to deal with, that racism in that medical field, in the medical arena, makes us scared to go to the doctor. So that's another reason we don't even go to the doctor, because we don't feel like we're going to get listened to or get adequate health care.
That's another layer. Yeah. So we could bring up every part of a woman's journey throughout the entire life cycle and bring up all the discrepancies that we're facing because we weren't added to research until 93. But let's keep it specific to your work. What moves are you excited to be making within the maternal health care space? And if you could share more about Light After Nine and also take us through a birthing experience in Rachel's ideal world.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to answer that question. So one of the biggest moves that I am making, which is pretty radical, and working in so many healthcare centers and hospitals and in different fields, I haven't seen it done, and it's not done often if it is. But I want to incorporate palliative care into maternal care. When we discuss palliative care or think about palliative care, a lot of people think about end-of-life care. And palliative care has so many different components. The part of palliative care that I want to incorporate into maternal health or maternal trauma care would be just making the treatment time comfortable, making it as pleasant as possible, hand-holding not just our pregnant persons, but also their families, answering all the questions, reiterating the information. It was so many pregnancies, and I'm a registered nurse, that information was told to me and I could not regurgitate it because I was in a mental space where I was trying to process a loss or an impending loss. I'm not trying to receive any information. I'm worried about my body and the baby that I won't ever get to hold, you know? So we need that hand holding. And then we need it after we leave the hospital, because what just happened to me? I still am not processing it. We need somebody or persons who are willing to stay with us from the bedside until after. That is the biggest move that I am making right now, is literally transforming the way maternal care is delivered.
That's a beautiful segue into a post I was going to bring up that you made recently on LinkedIn. Maternal health deserves a compassionate, holistic approach that includes palliative care, a service that's not just for end of life, but for the physical and emotional trauma many women face. And you wrote a recent article about how this can transform. Rachel, what is palliative care? I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, so We use palliative care in the hospital for multiple reasons. A lot of people, like I said, associated with end of life care, just making you comfortable. And comfort care is a part of palliative care.
Like hospice?
No, it's actually not hospice.
Okay.
So hospice is hospice. Palliative care can be a part of hospice treatment. Hospice is transitioning to end of life. Palliative care is all about comfort. We're
Okay.
making sure that person, whether it's end of life, whether we're bringing life into the world, is comfortable as possible during that treatment. So some palliative care services offer car rides to and from appointments. They offer phone calls if you feel nervous before a doctor's appointment and you're trying to gather your thoughts to ask different questions that you might have. It's bringing you popsicles because for your cancer treatment, you get sores in your mouth. You know, it could be anything. It's to make you as comfortable as possible during your treatment process. And we're in a maternal health crisis right now. We need that service. And we can't even begin to claim that we're giving women holistic maternal care during this process without including palliative care. It's impossible at this point.
Are you able to give palliative care in your day-to-day?
Yeah, so it depends on what our patients need, right? I'm virtual right now. My goal is to get at the bedside. I feel like it should start at the bedside and then when they go home, it could become virtual. So right now I'm just giving virtual palliative care by answering questions, giving resources, providing them with different tools that they may need. So if they're having sore breasts, I give them ice pads for that. You know, we send out different things as a company just to make sure, like I said, they're comfortable during this process. But we need to get at the bedside. We need to get there.
What do most people in the maternal experience have in lieu of palliative care? What would you describe?
So in my personal experience, I've seen and been given brochures doing my losses. There are companies out there. One in particular I'm thinking is called Rachel's Gift. When we have a loss, you get a box. It has a stuffed animal in it. It had a little head in it that ideally a very, very small baby would fit. It has resources for funeral arrangements and counseling, resources for the grandmother who may need counseling or the father or the children and how to have those conversations. Love that company, great resource. I've gotten that box a god awful amount of time, unfortunately, but it did make when I was thinking about something or what I needed to do after having the loss a little easier. But if it's not for those companies, you know, we're kind of like, what's next? We're depending upon a nurse who has a bunch of other patients and may just forget to even talk about a lot of things. You know, the nurse is in and out of the room. The doctor is in the room for maybe 5 minutes. You know, there's nobody there holding our hands. At most, there's a case manager. But if you don't have a complex case, they're barely in there a long time. There's nobody consistently there that you can call on to help you through that process if you need something. So that's why it's so imperative to start this process.
Right. And it, as an energy coach, I know that I had a me coming out of my mother was very traumatic. We both almost died. And I think there's so much trauma still in my womb space and hers from that experience, because it goes so much more beyond like that day.
Right.
How do you start to help people understand this? And again, this in today's world and the where we're rooted in these systems where we don't think these are maybe necessary. These types of services. How do we even start to understand beyond you and I who totally get it?
Right. So we have to approach it from different angles. We have to approach it from a patient family angle and do podcasts like these, get that message out there, put it on their mind, right? We have to also train the healthcare professionals to get in that mindset to start ordering this service for them. When you're in a hospital, you ask your doctor, hey, can we order a palliative care consult for this patient? It's literally that simple. That's
what?
It.
Oh, it already exists. Like, it's not even, it's like on the menu. What?
It's on the menu. Yeah. We order it all the time for, like I said, end of life.
Yeah.
Even as healthcare professionals, we associate it with only end of life, and we have to change that narrative in our mind. Mm-hmm. So we have to be in front of people, in front of the healthcare providers, in front of the families. So the patients are asking, the families are asking. The healthcare providers are also saying, you know what, I think you'll be a good candidate for palliative care in the maternal health space. I guarantee you it's not happening now, but it exists. There's a whole department in most hospitals, if not all.
So it's like, I wonder if it's like getting to every OB.
Yeah.
and making sure they know, like, hey, when you go to the hospital, ask for palliative care.
So those offices and everything. Right now, my mission is to get in front of people by doing podcasts, amazing podcasts like this. Also doing news stories. Also, I'm speaking at quite a few conferences next year for healthcare professionals that has thousands of people, and to hopefully get through to them. Because anytime I bring it up, it's like this radical idea, mind blown. But we should have had that.
Wait, yeah, and it's oh, by the way, it's always been there as an option, and we just didn't connect it. I don't know. My mind goes to this actually should be offered to any patient anytime. But
Agreed.
Let's keep it as moms right now, like moms giving birth.
Agreed.
Right? Like, it's such a traumatic, and I'm going to get really macro depending on how you look at it. Everything is energy. Energy is everything. Everything is stored like a voicemail inside your body. And if there's any sort of trauma throughout your entire life, that gets stored, that gets saved, downloaded.
Yeah.
This has become kind of a trope. It's like it becomes disease at some point, you know, and then it comes like a whole nother thing around illness and as we age and things like that. So if we could do anything as part of this, especially for women, it's become so traumatic to even step foot inside a doctor's office or a hospital because we're not listened to, or we just actually, I want to hear your thoughts on this, Rachel. Sometimes the answer is they just don't know.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, when you think about it, we're practicing medicine. We don't have the answers to everything, right? We're practicing medicine. That's what it's called. That's what it's called. You know, it's not falsely labeled. That is what it is. You know, you come into, God forbid, an ER as a pregnant woman. The ER is supposed to deal whatever that comes through that door. Do you know how many issues can come through an ER door? It's like an insane amount. Like, how could any practitioner or doctor overseeing care in the ER just know everything for every issue?
Mm-hmm.
Maternity care is one of those at the very bottom. Are you having a miscarriage? Are you pregnant? So miscarriage number 3, I went to the bathroom and the baby came out.
Mm.
Very traumatic. Probably my top pregnancy trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the ER and the ER doctor asked me, you know, what's going on? I said, well, I was 15 weeks pregnant. I went to the bathroom and the baby came out. She asked me, how do you know you were pregnant? At 15 weeks, I think I would know I'm pregnant. I said, do you want me to show you a picture of the baby in the toilet? She said, yes, so I could see. And I showed her and she said, oh my God, that's a baby. You know, so to even start my care that way with disbelief, you know, that I'm telling you what's happening to me and what has happened. It's crazy. How am I supposed to trust you? We already started without rapport. Like, it's just, I'm already not trusting you. So we have to think about how we're even treated when we go into these places, you know?
Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm so sorry that happened to you. And the first thing I would want to say if I were in that room, to your point about level setting, about coming into the ER and everyone seeing every possible scenario under the sun, and you might have expertise or experience in that, you might not. But the human thing to do, if I were the person sitting in front of you, is saying, are you okay? Do you hurt right now? Do you need to sit down? Or do you need towels or padding? To jump to not believing, it feels completely disconnected to the human experience. And why?
I don't know. I wasn't even in pain. That's the other issue. I never was in pain when I had a loss. It just, it was always a silent loss. It was so weird. Even when I was supposed to, per my doctor, it was supposed to be one of the hallmark signs. It just was smooth loss.
I feel like it's one more example about how we've gotten too much into the copy paste of how every human is the exact same. We haven't taken a step back and said, like, okay, what's needed in this very moment for this human in front of me?
Right. And if you don't know that, we need to make sure they're seeing the person who do knows. That's another thing. At the hospital that I used to consistently get care at, if you were less than 20 weeks, you had to go to the regular ER. And I mean, 19 weeks and 6 days, go to the regular ER. Issue is, every time I went to the regular ER and not the maternity ER, they were just like, why aren't you in the maternity ER? We don't know what to do. And they would end up sending me there. It was one night I went back and forth 4 times in a wheelchair.
Oh, Rachel.
I had high blood pressure, high heart rate. If I was standing up, I could not breathe. I ended up being put on oxygen during that pregnancy. It was crazy. And I went back and forth.
First of all, I didn't know that there was a maternal ER and a regular ER.
It depends on the hospital. But it depends on the hospital. Some hospitals, there's just a regular ER and they consult OBGYN. OBGYN was never consulted for me while I was down there. They
What
just
in the
kept
world?
they just kept calling the maternity ER and begging them to take me and just sending me up there.
Oh my gosh. So after your 9 experiences and your delivery experience, are you able to now go back to those people, those programs, those systems, those places, and give your story and also help them create something different?
So that would be a dream of mine because the hospital that I was seeking care at, they've been in the news multiple times for issues with maternity care,
Oh.
multiple times.
And they need to be shut down.
I wrote the Joint Commission, which is a governing body, about multiple experiences I've had there. I mean, multiple. I've written the CEO, I mean, the CNO, the chief nursing officer, and I've had conversations with her during my last pregnancy. For the delivery experience specifically, she made sure it was flawless. I told her everything that happened. They did internal investigations, still issues that have come out even recently. So a lot of change has to happen there, and it's a major hospital.
Wow.
So to know that you've been, I mean, on CNN, in the news that much for negative maternal care and, black women, black pregnant women are dying. We're number two for maternal mortality rates. It's scary,
And to your point, there aren't any other options. Access. A
Yeah.
access is the problem there.
Access is the problem.
Are you going to move when you become pregnant, to another town or state? Probably not.
Right. Can you even afford it after all the losses and bills? And it's a lot, you kind of take what you have, and the more high risk you are, the smaller and the less access you have. I mean, I was looking for a reproductive geneticist. I found one in Atlanta that was able to see me. So it's just difficult and it's scary.
So to your point, I love your idea about working through like the virtual aspect if they don't have access. It's almost like if I were in a situation where I were pregnant and I was preparing, I would want to like talk to you after every doctor's appointment to be like, okay, what does this mean? What does this mean? And tell me more about this and help me understand. Because again, I recently had my annual physical and I trust my primary care physician. But I had my annual physical and because of my blood work, they ordered a CT cardiac calcium scan to check for heart disease. I was like, what? What on my blood show? What happened? What? I was like, really, literally, like, what had happened? And they wrote back a 9-paragraph explanation through my health chart of like, here's what's happening and here's why and here's what's we're gonna do. And it was negative, which is good. But even going in that day of, there was no expectation of what to expect. I also think of when I first started getting mammograms 2 years ago, because I turned 40, I had no idea what to expect. And I wasn't told, hey, if it's your first mammogram, there's no past real estate report on your breast to show what's normal. So you're likely going to have to come back and get checked. I didn't know that. So again, I had my first one and oh, it hurts. It hurts.
I heard.
It hurts. And oh, by the way, after that, I was brought back. I was like, oh, I have cancer. This is bad. This is real. We're just not informed enough. And even in my scenario where like I have a great doctor, they're always on the go, rushed. And like I want somebody to always talk to me a little bit more. Because you said earlier, women of color just don't go to the doctor because they're not believed and it's this bigger discrimination. Imagine a person who has had any sort of sexual assault trauma in their past, like, are they going to want to go in for a mammogram or a pap?
That is just such a good point. It's just before an appointment, and your emotions are high, your hormones are all over the place, all these things. You need someone to kind of center you and be like, don't forget these questions, all those things. And when they come out, what happened? Oh, they took that lab. That's what this can mean. Do you have
Yes.
any questions about what they
Yes.
said? Do you have your discharge summary? We could just review it together just in case. You kind of space doing your appointment. All of that is important. That happens so much. Really, that could happen with anybody,
Yeah, anybody, any ailment. So it's almost like I want a healthcare concierge in between as part of the team. And
It's
don't
part of
get
the team.
don't get me started on psychiatrists. Getting that in the mix as well, because a lot of times primary care physicians don't agree with what psychiatrists are doing and vice versa. It's like, oh my God.
Right.
Okay. So with your personal lived experience and also what you serve and provide within Alive After Nine, and I'm so happy to hear that you're going to get on big stages. Knowing that from conception to delivery is about a year.
It depends on who you ask.
Oh, tell me more.
I mean, from conception to delivery, mine was 4 years. Just because you
Oh,
conceive
you're
don't
right. Oh
mean
my
you're
gosh.
gonna deliver.
Thank you so much for that clarification. From conception to delivery can be years.
It could be years.
Tell me and walk me through your way of transforming with palliative care, especially with your lived experience in mind.
Yeah, so when I first got pregnant in 2018, it was not planned, but it was with my soon-to-be husband. I was financially stable. I was fine. I was ready. I just didn't plan it. I was happy. I lost it 2 weeks later after I found out I was pregnant. The doctor said it's a part of normal pregnancy. You're gonna go on and you're gonna have babies and you're gonna be all right. When I tell you that was like the opposite of foreshadowing, because
Okay.
what? That did not happen at all. That did not happen at all. And over the course of my pregnancy journey, multiple doctors told me that despite of even having losses, I'm like, how are y'all so confident? This is, crazy. I wish I had this type of faith. That's blind faith, I guess. But in situations like pregnancy number 2 and 3, where I had pain throughout my pregnancy, lost the first baby, was a twin pregnancy, lost the first baby, lost the second one traumatically when I went to the bathroom. Pregnancy number 6 or 7, where I had to get a surgery at 13 weeks, begged the doctor to see me a week later. She said, no, I'm gonna see you at 20 weeks, which was 7 weeks later, and telling her and confiding in her that I was terrified that something would happen between the time. And she reassured me that you would feel excruciating pain if the suture that I put around your cervix didn't work. I felt no pain. I went to a 20-week appointment and the cerclage failed. And she told me, oh, well, you can go upstairs and deliver the baby. I said, won't the baby pass? She said, yes, there's nothing we can do. So experiencing that and flying to Dallas to try to save that pregnancy, undergoing surgery after surgery and all the other surgeries I had to get to try to stay pregnant, all the medications and hormones. I saw 5 different specialists. I had hundreds of appointments. I had thousands of tests and spent thousands of dollars. If I had palliative care during that time, my mental health would be better, I believe. I wouldn't have had 9 losses. I guarantee you that. If I had somebody who was in palliative care and also knowledgeable about maternal health, I would have known a lot of things sooner. I wouldn't have been as ignorant as I was going into my pregnancy journey or throughout my pregnancy journey. And despite of being a nurse, I was not a maternal health nurse. I didn't know anything about it. So I went in there with a knowledge of any other patient that's not in healthcare. So if I had that support, my outcome would have been significantly better. All my questions would have been asked. I would have advocated for myself better. I would ask for certain surgeries earlier. I would ask for medications earlier. I'm getting bits and pieces from different doctors and just bringing it into my primary doctor. And she would listen to me and order it. And sometimes she would say, no, I don't think that's right. I would have been far better off, way less losses. But also, I wouldn't have been here talking to you, Amy, because I probably,
Well,
but
you hit on such a key point, so many key points. And again,
yeah.
thank you so much for sharing your personal story. The moment you're on that raised medical bed, or you're on, like, you're in the hospital, or the moment you're in that ambiance, that environment where something is going awry, because a lot of people, I will hear a lot of people say, you've got to advocate for yourself. Your mindset. Especially like if you're hooked up to stuff, your mindset is not like, okay, I've got to keep my all of my rights as a human being and as a patient at the forefront. First of all, do I even know what those are? I didn't know. I learned a lot of things from a lot of my experiences that people are aghast. They're like, you need to report this person to the national something or other. I'm like, what? Not even knowing, Rachel, how does someone even know, especially a woman needing maternal care? How does she even know, she or they know, what to ask for, when, even to know the term palliative care, like, can they ask for that proactively? What would you say? What are the terms we should use? How do we even know when or how to advocate?
Right. So, great question. We can't advocate for ourselves if one, we don't know something is wrong or something needs to be addressed. Two, we don't have the education or information to speak up. And three, we don't have the confidence to do so, right? Because if I'm going in here, and like I said, I'm a registered nurse, I pride myself on having a lot of experience in a lot of different specialties. But in maternal health, I did not have this information at the time. So I couldn't tell my doctor, can we please place a cerclage, a transabdominal cerclage? That wouldn't have never occurred to me.
And what is that?
Exactly. And what
Cerclage,
is that?
what is that?
If
And
you would have asked me in 2018, 19, 20, I couldn't even answer that question. But transabdominal or transvaginal cerclage is a suture. It's a stitch around the cervix. The cervix is at the end of the uterus. It's what opens up and the baby comes out. When people give birth, they're like, oh, the cervix is dilating. That means,
That's the cervix is in between the actual vaginal birth canal and the
And it opens and then the baby starts poking, as you get closer to delivery. Mine, as soon as the baby got heavy, mine is so weak, it'll just open.
Oh,
And
wow.
then, the baby will fall out at 15 weeks, at 13 weeks, at, you know.
Is that a form of prolapse?
No, so prolapse means it'll just be going in. So cervical insufficiency is that it's just too weak, it just opens.
Okay, it just
It doesn't
opened.
go in.
Wow. And is this something common in women?
It's not super common, just on a grand scale of how many people are pregnant and things like that. It's not super common, but it's common enough that there's a gold standard to do transabdominal cerclage. First of all, we have to change that,
I
right?
mean, and my other question is, would this have been something that someone could have looked for in your cervix when you were getting Paps, like for how many other years? Is this something that somebody could have seen or looked for?
So, from my understanding, what my doctor said is that we wouldn't know until you get pregnant, you get far along enough for the baby to get some weight, around that after the first trimester, and then the baby falls out. Isn't
Oh
that
my God.
insane for us to have to
What?
figure it out by allowing a child to die?
What?
So the other issue, Amy, is that before we even get to a point where we're starting to go to a reproductive endocrinologist to really get evaluated for infertility and pregnancy loss and all these things, we have to have three miscarriages. Why do three babies have to die in order for me to get evaluated for this issue that I'm having? Why?
When you were naming numbers earlier, I was thinking about posting this episode live and talking about second, third, sixth, seventh. What?
Yeah. And we still didn't get it right until my 10th baby.
Oh.
I had to have nine so my 10th baby could walk. Why did I have to have nine losses? Why? And then the gold standard is to do a transvaginal cerclage. And then after that was placed, she was like, yeah, you're fixed, you're cured, you have this baby. It failed. So now I have to get a transabdominal cerclage, which is higher than the vaginal one, which has like a 99 per whatever success rate.
It goes like in the uterus, like even above
No,
the
it's not.
uterus.
So it's like if you have the transvaginal one, it's just lower. It's just lower.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And when I flew back to Texas for the second time, the doctor was like, honestly, Rachel, I would have put this in you the first time. You should have never gotten a transvaginal cerclage. And to hear that is heartbreaking. So you mean to tell me I shouldn't have ever lost nine
Right,
children?
right, right.
That's upsetting.
No, you shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, just get like a second, third, or fourth opinion.
I got that. I got that.
You're like, yep.
I got that.
And
My
they all,
medical bills will show you how many
oh,
opinions
yeah,
I
of
have.
course. So some of this, you had mentioned this earlier, like it's medical practice, and there's gotta be. I mean, the good news is there are people like you who are very well aware and have made the sacrifices for all humanity to understand.
Literally.
I mean, literally, and you shouldn't have had to. And you're here saying, here's what's happening, here's what we know. And now you can be on the forefront. You are on the forefront to changing it and beyond. I mean, palliative care is something that should be so normalized in every
Yeah.
healthcare situation, but further, you're on the cusp, on the leading edge to understanding more about miscarriages and why things might be maybe happening. Because again, me as a person who's never been pregnant, a lot of times I've heard women being told, well, you miscarry because there was something wrong with the baby. That's not true.
Right. How many more losses do we have to get it right? How many sacrifices? How many children are we going to sacrifice to get maternal care, where it needs to be? It's scary.
Thank you for being on the forefront. Thank you for being the pioneer that we need. And may you not experience any more loss.
I mean, I won't experience the loss of a child again. I'm having my tubes tied in a month.
Oh my
Yeah.
gosh, Rachel, where can we find you and all of your work? And can we sign up for something so we can hear your words more often?
Yeah, absolutely. I always put articles on LinkedIn. You can follow me at Rachelle Dumas. And then my website is alightafternine.org for those going through fertility issues and trying to get pregnant or pregnant, dealing with the aftermath of pregnancy, my pregnancy survivors out there, as I like to call us. Please visit my website. It's a host of resources, especially grants, because it's not cheap at all to receive healthcare in the United States of America. So you can also follow me on Instagram at alightafternine, as well as TikTok, Rachelle Dumas RN. And I'm always posting resources, things to ask your doctor, how to come back, medical gaslighting, grants. And if you want me to post anything or have questions or need our services, I am not charging you. Please come.
Can we set up a webinar together of some sort?
Love to.
A Light After Nine, by the way, is a really beautiful name. Like I feel that name.
Yeah, I felt it too. I came up with so many different names, and then that one, I was like, no, I had nine losses. It have to be something with nine, and it has to be a ray of hope at the end.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Closing remarks as we wrap up.
Thank you for having me. I am honored to be on your podcast. It's been amazing talking to you. I like to talk to you. You're such a light yourself. And for any women out there struggling with pregnancy, need to talk. Need advice at a standstill, just you're done or you're just beginning. Please reach out to Alight After Nine. We help at all stages, preconception, conception, delivery, and postpartum.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.